Hey, B4.
B4.
Cards ready. Play some bingo. So there was this gray goose that went into a pub. The barman says, "Hey, we've got a drink named after you." And the goose said, "What, George?" That's pretty good.
Share. Oh, yeah.
lands, the barn or lands, they were in his mind. Abusion captured high, where reason captured his time. In no time at all, he took me to the gate. In haste, I quickly checked the time. If I was late, I had to leave to hear your wondrous stories. Questions from you. I think somebody was going to write some down for me. Did anybody write some down?
Oh, yeah.
Ask them, or throw them, or fly them to me. And I can ask a few, answer a few questions. And maybe if somebody wants to hear a special song, I'll try and remember it.
Onward.
Onward through the night of my life. That was written by Chris Squire. He doesn't sleep very well. Onward through the night. You know, that's why he wrote that song. Okay, well, of course, I haven't got my glasses, which is kind of cool. Okay, who's good at reading? Like, you're reading me.
Those young eyes out there.
These young guys down at the front here. Hey, that's for me. Any chance of me?
Plus Rick. Doing the 360 tour in the U.S.
That's up to Rick, actually. We're, you know, me and Rick have been, we did a show about 4 years ago in the U.K. And, you know, Rick Wakeman, it's a joke and a song, and then a joke and a joke, you know, a joke and a song. And with Rick, it's very hard to be on stage with him because he's just a funny guy, and it's very hard to sing when somebody's looking at you with a strange look in his eyes and playing the chords, playing the wrong chords to the song. So I finish up laughing quite a lot on that tour. And earlier this year, he called me and said, would I like to do the UK tour again? And I said, yeah, can we come to the US? He said, well, John, let's do the US first, because he has so many TV commitments in England. Sorry?
The UK.
Sorry?
He said that
to
the UK.
Did he? Yeah, he said that's too. Did I say US?
Yes.
Oh. Okay.
You're native now.
Yes, I'm an American now. Okay. I became an American earlier this year. Yeah, he said, yeah, okay, we'll do the UK first and we'll see how it goes. And knowing Rick, he's very committed to being a sort of celebrity in England on the TV, and he does these crazy sort of one show that he does called Grumpy Old Men, and he, you know, he talks about life being a grumpy old man, I think that's what he does. And but Rick has the most interesting thing that he says about me on his show is that, you know, John Anderson's the only guy that he knows trying to save this planet while living on another one. And all the jokes that I might say tonight are all from Rick anyway. So here's another one. The polar bear goes into the bar and says, I'll have a pint of beer and a packet of crisps. And the barman says, why the big pause? These guys don't get it. Another question.
You've traveled too many places around the world. What are some of your favorite places in the world?
I've been very lucky to be able to, you know, be a musician all my life. Well, most of my life. And last year, me and Jane you know, I got pretty sick the year before, so I didn't actually sing for about 6 months. And so me and Jane went to Paris, and Paris is one of the most amazing cities. If you've never been to Europe and you're thinking of going, go to Paris. Because Paris is just an extraordinary city. And we stayed there for about 2 or 3 weeks, and I would sort of fly, we would fly to Poland and then fly to Czechoslovakia, fly to London at the weekend and do a show. But living in a city like Paris is just amazing. But on tour with Yes, there were so many amazing experiences that I went through. There's one time that we were playing, you know, through the 90125 time, and we were famous, you know, like we had a hit record and we were treated like superstars for a while. It was kind of amazing going through that experience. And we went down to Brazil, and we were doing a concert, and we played in front of 500,000 people.
Wow.
In this amazingly big field, of course. You have 500,000 people, and they were having so much fun. And we did our show, the 90125 show, and it was a big record in Brazil. And I've always loved going to Brazil, and the people down there. I always remembered that, you know, they live for music. They really live for music. And I always thought, like, people sort of above the what do you call it, the equator, north of the equator, they live off music, whereas people below the equator live for music. It's just an interesting experience. And you know that
São Paulo.
Is that São Paulo? Sorry,
look.
São Paulo.
I'm going to say the gun.
Sorry? Oh, yeah. Sorry, I'll explain that. We did the show, I think it was 1984, around that time. And our next gig that we were going to do was Argentina. And so we flew down to Uruguay, which is next to Argentina. And we were going to play football stadiums, one football stadium, actually two big football stadiums, because we were like, you know, number one around the world with Honor of the Lonely Heart. And so the day before we were going to go there, and you have to remember, a year before, or a couple of years before or so, England had gone to war with Argentina over a little island just off the coast of Argentina. And it'd been a terrible war. Do you remember that?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Falklands, yeah. The sheep, you know, there's a lot of sheep on the Falklands. And it was just a crazy idea that the British Navy would, you know, sneak up on the Argentine, you know, army. It took them 3 weeks to actually get there with the boats and everything and the big battleships. And it was a terrible, terrible thing to do that. They actually tested out one of their missiles on, and it hit a troop ship that was actually, an Argentinian troop ship, that was actually sailing out of the war zone. And it killed a lot of people. And so there was, you know, we were the first English band to actually play in Argentina after the war. And so the manager came to us and said, guys, I've got some good news. And I got some bad news. And I said, okay, what's the good news? Oh, you sold out. You know, 50,000 people each show, but they've started, it's called the April the 13th group, they were called, because on April the 13th, that's when happened, when the missile hit the ship. And they started throwing smoke bombs and at people buying tickets. And they've threatened to shoot at the band. They're going to come to the show and try and kill somebody in the band. And Chris turned around and said, it'll be the singer. Okay. So we actually did the show, and I ran around that stage like a mummy. Yeah, I just had to, you know, keep out of the way.
Where did he kill you?
I don't know. Thank you. Show. They do a Christmas show, and it's extraordinary. It's they invited me to go and be the guest singer at the end of the show and sing Roundabout. And so I said, well, you know, I've always wanted to do a Christmas show, so why not? You know, just come and sing one song. It'd be a lot of fun. And we went up to, I think it was the capital of California. It was Sacramento. And we went up there, and it was just a wonderful experience. This band, this guy, he puts on an incredible show with laser beams and light shows that you cannot imagine. It's kind of a heavy metal Christmas show, and it works. And people go in their thousands to watch it, and you know, it was just a great experience. And I have to tell one story. I was backstage, just finished singing Roundabout, you know, and the guy who actually puts the show on, this guy called Paul, is a really sweet guy, comes in and says, hey man, there's a really important guy coming to see you, you gotta come out and meet him. And I was just putting my shirt back on, I said, yeah, I'll be out in a minute. No, he's very important, his name is Tony La Russa. And I said, I don't know, who's this guy? I said, Tony La Russa, he's the manager of the St. Louis Cardinals. And I said, baseball? Okay. So I thought, oh, well, I'll go and say hi, you know, I don't mind saying hi. So I went into the hallway outside the dressing room, and there's this guy, lovely guy with his wife, with the suit and everything, and the jacket. And as I'm walking towards him to give him a handshake, he opens up his shirt and he has a Yes t-shirt on. And I said, yay! And we've actually become friends, and he's an incredibly sweet guy, he really is. And him and his wife do this amazing saving animals, you know, looking after dogs and cats that have been really sort of beaten up. And it's a group called ARF, A-R-F. And I did a show for them last January. It was kind of fun. Let's sing another song.
Show you a child who is lonely. I would
once showing a child who is lost and afraid. Everybody seems to lose their sense of what they believe in, misunderstanding what is true. Anyone in love can realize that all that you need is to be good to yourself. And we worked on a farm, and we used to sing all day long, just in the early 60s. And of course, just before the Beatles, we'd sing Everly Brothers songs or Buddy Holly, so it was into rock and roll, you know. And the idea of becoming a musician was so far away, but you know, you work hard at what you gotta work hard at, you know. And I just chase the cows, milk the cows, deliver milk, haymaking in the summer, and I really had a great time. I enjoyed working. But my brother had a band called The Warriors, and they had two singers in the band. Gordon, who was the other singer, Tony's my brother, the other singer's called Gordon, he decided he wanted to be a hairdresser. So my brother said, John, you know, why don't you join the band? Because we sing the Everly Brothers songs, you know, and stuff like that. And the Beatles actually had just released their first single, Love Me Do. And me and my brother went to see the Beatles play in a place called Southport, which is kind of north of Liverpool. And we watched the Beatles play, and there was about 500 people just standing there. There was no screaming, and it was amazing to watch this band play. They played amazingly good, and they played the whole of their first album, and it gave us the idea, hey, you know, why don't we go as a band, and why don't we go and play the Cavern? And that's what really spurred us on to be a musician, to be in a band, you know. Wanted to be a Beatle. It's true. You know, I used to talk like that a lot, you know. I used to talk like I was from Liverpool. And I remember going into a hamburger place in Liverpool, and I said to the lady behind the counter, I said, can I have a hamburger, please, with chips? And she said, you're not from around here. I said, no, I'm from Accrington. It's kind of nearby. You know. In fact, I'll sing a song about it, if you like.
Yeah.
Tony and me, we had a real good time in a rock and roll band back in 63. We had it going strong, playing music all night long. Tony and me, we had work to do down on the farm, but we would sing all day, just the blues away. We just wanted wanted to go and play in Liverpool. All those Beatles songs, she loves you, yeah, 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 yeah. And those Everly Brothers, wake up little Susie, wake up. Wake up little Susie, wake up. Tony and me, we had a real good time in a rock and roll band back in 63. We had it going strong, make music all night long. Tony and me, we worked on the bar, we didn't have a care. We would sing all day, chase the blues away. Drink too much and chase the girls all the time. Oh, all those Beatles songs, she loves you, yeah, 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 yeah. Those Beach Boys songs, help me run, help, help me run, help me run, help, help me run, help me run, help, help me run, help me run. We had a show in a place called Sheffield, which is sort of just south of Manchester in England. When we did a show, we had to do about 4 shows a night. We did our first show, and the manager came over and said to us, hey, can a friend of mine get on stage and sing a song with your band? You're a good band. And he said, okay. And this tubby guy came around the corner with a pint in his hand and said, I'd like to sing Hit the Road Jack. Do you know Hit the Road Jack? And we said, yeah, we know that. So the guy got up on stage and sang Hit the Road Jack. He sounded just like Ray Charles. He was amazing. He said, what's your name? He says, my name is Joe Cocker. I'm 16 years old. True story. And on the way home, we were driving over the moors. And, Sheffield to Accrington, you go over these moors called the Pennines. And it's very dark, and it was sort of midnight. A lot of mist around. No traffic for miles. And right in the middle of the road, there was a big box about this big. And it had obviously fallen off a truck, you know. So we stopped the van and looked around. There's nobody around. Quick, get it in the van. Put it in the van. Started driving home and started thinking, gosh, it could be a box full of watches. It could be cameras. It could be transistor radios, you know. So we got the box home. We put it in our front room. We opened it up. It was 500 pairs of extra large underpants. Tony and me, we had a real good time in a rock and roll band back in 63. He was taller than me, Tony and me. I used to look up to my brother because he was taller than me. Thank you. That's a good question. Am I still part of Yes? I'm not in the band anymore. They just wouldn't wait around while I got healthy and wanted to go on the road, and that's their decision.
Their loss.
Yeah, but things happen. I think one of the interesting things was I was getting sick before 2008. I was on tour the last time with Yes. I was pretty bad. I was coughing a lot, and no doctor for miles could understand what was wrong with me. So what happened was, after a period of time, I said, I can't tour the way we're touring. It's just driving me crazy. Why don't we do sort of less touring, maybe? Do an acoustic album, and then I can get my strength back, if you like, you know. And they just didn't really want to do that. So you have to start take it in and say, okay. And that's when I started doing solo shows, which was kind of interesting, because when I started rehearsing a solo show, I realized it's very lonely on stage if you don't know what you're doing, you know. A little bit like now, you know. But the idea was I'd practice and practice at home, you know, and get the songs together. And I went to the local high school to ask if I could sort of rehearse on the stage that they had in a little theater in the high school. And the manager of the theater said, what's your name again? I said, John, I just live over the up the hill. He said, well, I don't know if we can let you use the stage unless you could teach a class.
Oh,
and I said, yeah, I can do that. And then the following day, about, you know, I went there at 12 o'clock, and about 60 teenagers came and sat there and looked at me and said, come on, teach us something. So I started talking about what it's like to live in America, you know, how amazing America truly is, and how wonderful it is to be able to travel the world. But when you come back to America, you realize what Americans truly have. It's an incredible life that you have here. And I talked to the kids about various things, and I asked them a very simple question, which was, do you have any classes about Native American culture? And collectively, they all said, no, we don't have anything about Native American culture. And ever since I came to live in America, that's all I wanted to learn about, Native American culture, you know, the indigenous people of this part of the world. And I was so surprised. I actually got into trouble with the teacher by telling the kids they should learn about Native American culture, because they have so much to show us. They believe that they are the caretakers of the Earth Mother, you know. And it's a very powerful thing to learn that the Native Americans are still not really represented in Congress, if you like, or in the UN. But actually, as it happened this year, it was a wonderful year where they were, what's the word, when they went to the UN, it was the indigenous people of the world. They collectively went to the UN, and they were graciously accepted as human beings on this planet. Because before, because they're not landowners, they could never be part of the United Nations. And now that they are, I feel that's an incredible breakthrough. But we're still a long way to go to understand the indigenous people are part of our knowledge of this Mother Earth. And we should start to remember who they are, and start to listen to who they are, and read about who they truly are. And that's not just the American Indian, but the indigenous people of the world. And so that's what I started talking to these young people about, and how fortunate they were to live in America. And it was a great experience. I forgot what the question was, but oh yeah, why am I not with the band anymore? Okay. But what happened was, it gave me, like, slowly the doors were opening, and it gave me the chance to work with people around the world via the internet. And that's what I've been doing in the past 3 or 4 years. I put an advert on my website, Musicians Wanted, and I got musicians from all over the world who wanted to work with me. And it was a great gift to have that in my life. And so I've been writing songs and writing musicals and writing some beautiful, interesting work for, like, violin concertos that I would never dream of doing, even though eventually start to realize that maybe it's meant to be the way it is, and I need to move on with my career and try out different avenues of creation, because why not, you know? I think I actually did a conversation very similar to this in the Cleveland, the Hall of Fame, Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And one person shouted out, well, when are you going to get back with the band? And I said, well, when we get inducted to the Hall of Fame. Sensing all ocean with you is the ocean made. Oh, complete in the sight of seeds of life with you. Started the band in 68, we had a drummer, and all of a sudden he was rehearsing with the band. And we were actually at that time we were called Mabel Greer's Toy Shop.
Yeah.
That's Chris's idea. Yeah. Stayed up all night working that one out. And, so the drummer decided to join another band and go to France. Halfway through our first week of rehearsing. So we answered an advertisement in the music press, drummer looking for band. So we rang up this guy, Bill Bruford, and we said, hi, Bill, and the first question is, what kind of kit have you got? What kind of drum kit? It's a Ludwig kit. Oh, he's great, must be good. He's got a beautiful drum kit, which turned out not to be a Ludwig kit. He'd taken the name Solner off and painted it black and pretended it was a Ludwig kit. You find out. Anyway, he joins the band. He said he had a van, and it was a minivan, which is like so tiny we couldn't get in. But and it was his girlfriend's. But he got in the band anyway. So we rehearsed for about 3 weeks, 4 weeks, and then started doing some shows. And we did our third show, and Bill turned around and said, I'm leaving the band, I'm going to become a lawyer. And I said, Bill, we just rehearsed the whole show, you're in the band. He said, no, I'm going to Leeds University, and I'm going to be a lawyer. He said, you're crazy, you're a great drummer. You know, he had a certain style which was kind of amazing, a sort of cross between jazz and rock sort of style drumming. Very interesting kind of drummer. And a very intellectual sort of person as well. Anyway, he left the band, and I said, okay. And he went to Leeds University, and it just happened that about a month later, we found another drummer, and he came in the band, and we went on tour, and we played Leeds University. And there was Bill in the audience, listening to Yes, because by then we'd become Yes, play this music that he knew inside out. And I could see that look in his eyes saying, I want to be back in the band. I don't want to be a lawyer. He was one of those guys very south of England, very, very British. He wasn't going to let us know. And he came backstage and he said, very good show, very good show, very good show. He kept saying that. Bill, why don't you come back in the band? He says, no, I can't. I'd like to, yes. Are you asking me? I said, well, yeah. I mean, actually, we'd just been offered to play a show in London at the Royal Albert Hall. Wow. It was the Cream Farewell Concert, and we'd been offered the chance to open up. And so I said, Bill, we're going to play Cream's farewell concert at the Albert Hall, and we'll buy you a Ludwig kit. So, that's what we did. We bought him a Ludwig kit. He rejoined the band, and he was a real character, of course, but a real great jazz drummer, jazz style. And a lot of young musicians do enjoy the Bill Bruford style of music, you know. And then we got into our albums, you know, we did the Yes album, and then we did Fragile, and all of a sudden it was like success was there. It was an amazing feeling to get this amazing recognition for the work that we rehearsed quite a lot. I think the reason we rehearsed so much is because certain things used to happen. You know, we rehearsed our first album, we did our second album, and then we went down to this club in London, and we saw King Crimson do their first show in this club. And I just looked at Chris and said, I've got to start rehearsing again. That is great. It was Court of the Crimson King, and they just played it all, and the whole show was the album. It was unbelievably good, and it really freaked me out. So, the next thing that happened, we were on tour in America, and we'd done Fragile, the album, and we were actually on tour, for some reason, with the Kinks. And we were getting, Roundabout hadn't come out, so we hadn't really broken as yet into the big world of success in America. But we were on tour with the Kinks, and I remember we did a show in New York. And Ray Davis is famous for being a crazy guy, because they, you know, the Kinks were pretty big in 63, 64, 65 in England. They were really a big band. But Ray Davis, or is the brother? What's the brother called?
Dave Davis.
He's the loony.
Yeah.
But I remember we had to go on stage and do an hour, and Ray said, "Just John, just make sure it's 1 hour." And we said, "Yeah, no problem." Thinking, screw that, you know, if we're going to get an encore, we're going to stay on, you know, because we want a, you know, want a break. They're famous. We're just trying to have a break. And I remember we did an hour, and then the crowd was going crazy. They wanted one more. And we just recorded Yours and No Disgrace. And the album hadn't come out, Fragile. And not Fragile, the Yes album. Anyway, it doesn't matter what year it was, but I remember Dave Davis looking at me, holding the plug at the wall. I told you to come off. That was very, very rock and roll, you know. Didn't get into a fight or anything. But it was a couple of days later, we were up in New York University, and we'd heard about this band that was opening up for Yes and the Kinks. It was a band called Mahavishnu Orchestra. That freaked me out, totally. To see a band of musicians that were so damn good on such an incredibly new level of music, that I just turned around to Chris and said, I think we've got to start rehearsing. And Bill was, you know, happy about it. He got on very well with Billy Cobham. And we did the next album. I think that we tried was Close to the Edge. And I sensed that there was this sort of energy between Chris and Bill, because I don't know if there's any musicians here, but when you're playing in a band, it's as though the first beat is the bass drum, not the bass. The bass drum is the first, and then everything happens after that, on that level. And Chris would say, no, it's the bass. It's the bass that starts everything. And Bill and Chris would have this big to and fro about it. And we did this album, which I thought was an amazing experience to do, Close to the Edge. I was very interested in expanding the musical horizons of the band. All very talented musicians. Well, why not do longer pieces of music and hold an audience for a longer period of time? Because it was slowly happening anyway, just the way we wanted to create our music. And then we finished the album, and out of the blue, Bill said, I'm leaving the band. And I said, wait a minute, we've just done one of the great albums of all time, in my mind, you know,
yes,
in my world. And you're leaving the band. He said, yeah, I'm going to go and join King Crimson. And I said, well, you could have punched me in the face. You would really hurt, you know. But after a while, you know, things happen, you say, well, it was meant to be. and we've been rehearsing. We had a drummer. We just started rehearsing close to the edge. And Eddie Alford, who was our engineer in the studio making records, he said, listen, I know this guy, Alan White. And I said, Alan White, who played on Imagine? Yeah. And he'd like to join the band. I said, get him in the band. He's amazing. And of course he was. He was, and is, a great man. He's a real gentleman. Gosh, he worked with John Lennon. You know, what else do you want to know? And he was a totally different kind of drummer. More heavy rock and roller, real driving force, you know. And but a very interesting guy, you know. Alan writes music on the piano, and we wrote some songs together. And so I had this real strong feeling about working with Alan, like a brother, you know. He was my best man at our wedding, and he was a beautiful guy. But quite an amazing drummer. He just holds it down. And then I did a tour with Bill Bruford in towards the end of the 80s, and it was very refreshing to see Bill playing. He had a band called Earthworks. It was kind of an amazing band too. Do I say amazing a lot? No, probably do. But you know, that was a very interesting time. I was actually thinking about any requests.
Buddha song.
Buddha song. Oh my gosh. Do I remember it? Oh my gosh. Take away the walls and break the big expansion. They've been running out of time to change the course. They'd be cutting down the children to forget you. They'd be dancing on the ones that use the force. They'd be dancing on the mercies of the force. This is your life. This is your time. You are the love. Wrote the chorus, which I'll sing in a minute, but I remember it. I wrote it on the way to the local Safeway. I'll say Safeway because there's one here. But it's called Albertsons, where I live. I have this thing about walking around, and I just love shopping. Once or twice a week, I get the trolley and I'm in there. And I love cooking, so I go in there. And on the way to the stores or wherever I'm going around where we live. We live in actually a place called the Royal Grande, me and Jane. We just live outside of the village. And the village is not unlike this village. This one is a little bit bigger, but it's the same energy. It's quite beautiful. And as I drive around, I started listening to Christian radio for two reasons. It's a good radio. The recordings are very good. Some of the songs are pretty good too, but the recordings, the production, that's what I started listening to on the Christian radio. And I thought, I hear this sort of thing about, you know, this, the Christian radio, this thing about Jesus is great, Jesus is love, and God is the way, and Jesus is the way to God, and we love you, Jesus. And I think that's really good. But then I think, I'm sure there's somebody in China driving to the local store, and he's got the Buddha radio on, and he's listening to Buddha music. And then I'm sure there's a guy in India listening to Krishna music. And I'm sure there's a guy in Iran listening to Mohammed music. And of course there is, because music is a very constant. So I wrote the chorus, and I'll sing the chorus now for the real mission. I want to thank you, Buddha, for being my teacher. I want to thank you, Jesus, for bringing this love. I want to thank Mohammed for being the prophet and singing the Krishna from heaven above. You never know. Please.
Speaking of Christian music, you did one song with For Him on Stream.
Oh.
How did that come about? Did you actually meet them, or was it you were in one studio, they were in another?
That's exactly what happened. We were halfway through making an album in Vancouver called The Ladder. And me and Jane had I just had nowhere to live, actually, at that time. It was one of those wonderful experiences where we were sort of homeless, but very happy. And a friend of mine has a studio in Franklin, near Nashville, a guy called Robin Crowe. And he invited me down. Why don't you come down for Christmas and we can write some music? I said, yes. So we went down to live in Franklin for the Christmas period while we had a break of making the record. So I was in the studio writing songs with Robin, and the band next door was For Him. And he just, one of the guys kind of came in and sort of, hello John, how are you? We're big fans, you know, we love what you do, we love your voice, can you come and sing the chorus? And I said, yeah, of course, why not? It's very, you know, not many people ask me, so I said, yeah, I'd love to. So I went in and sang the chorus, and it became quite a hit record, I believe.
I like it.
I like it too. I can't remember it, but I like
the only
it.
Thing.
Hey. But another question, please, from the. Because I feel like I'm on. It's called American Idol. You're the judges. What we got?
How do you compose your special lyrics?
Special lyrics, yeah. Most of the time when I'm writing songs, I do this thing Jane calls opionium. Is it opionium? Sort of thing. Where I'll sort of mimic an idea in my head as I'm singing it. And eventually I'll record what I'm trying to sing. And when I hear what I've been trying to sing, I sort of formulate what I'm trying to say that way. Does that sound coherent or vague? Does that sound vague? I was thinking of what I was actually doing one song today that I wrote with Alan, actually. And the story is about, I'll just sing a little bit of it. The story is about a sculptor creating a sculpture of his wife or his girlfriend in a sort of, I think it was song called Turn of the Century. The idea of the song is about, thank you. Well, wait a minute, I'm telling you. I'm just gonna ramble through it. But the idea was realizing a form out of stone, set plants moving, Rohan shaped his heart through his working hands, worked to mold his passion into clay. In his room, his lady, she would dance and sing so completely.
So be still, he now cries, I have time for it. Quickly transform this soul.
This idea of, I think it's maybe an old story of his girlfriend dies in the winter, they have no money or whatever, and she dies, and he keeps working on the sculpture until it becomes alive, and they get back together again. It was a very sort of strong, sort of symbolic thing about, I don't know, there's something about that. But, you know, writing lyrics, I'm just writing lyrics now with Rick Wakeman for the tour. As it happened, you know, I asked Rick if we're going to do a tour this October in the UK, we should write some new songs. And he said, no problem, John. That was about 3 months ago. He started sending me the music last week. You know, Rick. And all of a sudden I'm on tour, I have a laptop, I have a microphone, and I'm actually writing songs and composing every day. So today I was writing this lyric, and it's a song that just sort of popped in there, the idea of, how's it going, sort of, where are you, what's it called, oh gosh, I can't remember what it's called now, but I'm just trying to remember the idea that I'll just mimic an idea and it'll come to me. Like, where are you, that mystic voice when I need help to understand something that's going on? And that was a lyric that I was doing today. And another question, please.
John, when you're dealing with musicians that are so strong rhythmically, like Phil Bruford, Chris Squire, and you're coming from such a melodic background.
Yeah.
Where does it come from? Where does it meet? Where does it start?
I think the idea is that, like, with a song like Long Distance Run Around. It's a very simple idea. From time away, always in the sound. I still remember the dream there.
I write
these songs, you know, and I'll take them to the band and they'll all start strumming along. I said, no, can you just go good, 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 because I listened a lot to Stravinsky, you know, Sibelius and all these beautiful composers. So, and they look at me and say, John, what's the matter with you? It would sound really cool if you did that. And basically that's how I worked with the band. You know, they're very highly evolved musicians for one thing, but I was the sort of the glue in the middle that would stick it together and say, okay, what we should try is an introduction for this piece, like, you know, Yours is No Disgrace, bum-ba-bum-bum-bum-ba-bum-bum, sort of introduction. Everybody play that, and then and the theme, da-da-da-da-da-da. John, what were you singing before? I think I got it from Bonanza or something. You know, it's true. In fact, you should know the piece that I'm talking about. That comes from an old English TV series about Dixon of Dock Yard, of the Scotland Yard. Scotland Yard is a very famous police. Sure. It's like a modern day Law and Order, basically. Like in that time, and the introduction was bum 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 bum. I thought it was so cool. So I got the band to play it. And that's how I work with the band. I sort of sit in the middle and sort of come up with ideas, because I would hear ideas and then suggest how to play things and then sing ideas, and they'd start working on that idea, and as they were rehearsing that part, I'd be thinking of the next part and listening to tapes that we'd rehearsed ideas with, you know, and the next part would come and I'd sort of guide them along. And that's how we did the longer pieces and Close to the Edge. I actually wrote with Steve Howe one afternoon, and we were on tour, and I envisioned the whole thing with Steve, because with Steve it was so easy because he had so many chords, he could play anything on guitar. So me and him was very, very, very close to that period of time in my career, and it was easy to work with him because I'd just say, well, play some different chords while I sing the same melody over the top. And he just figured it out and worked on the next chord sequences, you know. It's just amazing when you think about working with very talented people and being able to guide them. And they were very open and very, what's the word? They trusted you. And I just had that exactly same experience just 2 months ago with teenagers on Long Island. I went to work with the teenagers from School of Rock. I did some shows with them. They're called the School of Rock All Stars. And it's just about 8 or 9 of the really talented kids, you know. And in fact, when I worked with these kids, they were 12, 13, 14 years old. Same age as you guys. You were 14? 13. Same age as these guys. And they play guitar, play drums, keyboards. They were playing Frank Zappa music when I met them.
Oh, wow.
And they do Yes music, and they do Beatles songs and sort of modern grunge music and all sorts of modern stuff as well. But they're very, very highly talented kids, and you know, the idea to work with them was fantastic. So I took them on tour, about 25 of them, girls and guys, and it was chaos. It was wonderful chaos. And I kept in touch with a bunch of them, and now they're 16, 17, 18 now, it's about 4 years ago. And we were working together in Long Island on a large scale of Yes style music. And it was really amazing. The feeling that I got was exactly like it was in 72. They were excited, they wanted to do it, and they were having fun. And that's what happened when you know, you're working with young people. They're very, very eager to learn stuff. And they performed amazingly well. And it'll be a piece of music that will come out sometime early next year. And I think the idea that what happened was, whenever I did solo work, I would never try to do Yes music. What for? Because, you know, Yes music is working with Chris and Steve and Alan and Rick or whatever. And that's Yes music. I can't go off and do a solo show or an album and do Yes music. It'd be silly, you know. But now that I'm emotionally not tied to those guys, I can, because Yes music is in my DNA, you know, I can now create Yes music that I want to do. So that's what happened just a couple of months ago. It was a very exciting time for me, because I know I want to do one every year. I want to do large scale pieces again and open up that musical vista, because people are very interested in it, you know, and young people actually like it, and it's kind of interesting. And what was the question?
Thank you, John.
Was that,
that was perfect.
Good.
Hey, John, I saw the School Rock shows, and they were just enthralling.
Yeah.
And what I was wondering is how much commitment are you months with these kids? These kids are amazing.
No, basically, they rehearsed what they were going to, they chose the music they wanted to perform, and sent me a list of songs they were rehearsing, and then I'd get together with them, and all I had to say to them was, can you slow it down? You know, they were doing Heart of the Sunrise, like 1,000 miles an hour. It's a hard piece of music, too. And they are beautiful, not only great players, they're just beautiful kids. I'm going to call them kids, they're beautiful people. I think through music and through what they've been going through, learning all these styles of music, I think it just makes them better people. I don't know why.
John,
yeah.
Through your music, you're always, you know, you really feel like you're dealing with a higher power.
Yeah.
And you sing that to all of us.
Yeah.
Was there one thing in all of your tours with Yes that made you realize that, you know, there was something bigger out there to help ground you? Because being on tour has to be so complicated.
Yeah. I think, there was a couple of things happened in the early days of touring with DS. Jamie Muir, who was a drummer who played with King Crimson, he was this extraordinary, he wasn't so much a drummer, he was a percussionist, musician. So when I went to see Bill Bruford in King Crimson, I was very interested in why he left the band, you know, and he was doing, I think the album was called Discipline, I think. And so the band was on stage, and Bill was playing a very tight drum kit, you know, and Jamie Muir was jumping around like a wild man with long hair, jumping up against the pieces of metal, with crashing metal and bashing the floor. He had microphones, and he'd bash on the floor in tempo with everything. And it was an extraordinary event to see this percussionist diving around the stage. And about a month later, Bill Bruford got married, so I went to his wedding, and Jamie was there. And I went up to him. I was kind of scared to say hello, because he was just this amazing energy, you know. And I said to him, how do you do what you do? That's all I said. I said, wait a minute. And he went away, and he came back with a piece of paper. He said, go and buy this book. And it was called The Autobiography of a Yogi by Paramahansa Yogananda. And it changed my life. The whole idea of that book, because I was on tour, and you know, you're out on tour, there's a lot of things can happen on tour. Everybody goes out after a show, there's bars and bands and all that stuff, and I really wasn't into that. I'd stay in my room, I'd paint and listen to Sibelius, play my harp. For some reason, I was just into that world. And I started reading about this guy who studied the world religion, that we are all connected, and all religions are connected. And it just it opened up my whole state of mind that there's a reason for me being in Yes, and that I'm singing about waking up, you know, close to the edge of realization. A lot of people said it was close to the edge of chaos, you know. To me, it was close to the edge of realization. And it came just at the right time. And from then on, whenever I started writing music or thinking music, and that's why when the next step was after Close to the Edge, I wanted to do a larger piece, which was Tales from Topographic Oceans, which is something that was inside this book, you know, about the revelation of life, the revelation of music, and what music can do to people. And I'm still on the path, you know, I'm singing about that today.
Soon.
Soon or soon the light.
Yeah. Please.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Soon.
I would sing this to thousands and thousands of people. And at the time, I really didn't know what the light truly was. Our reason to be here.
The song that precedes that on Relayer.
Case of Delirium.
How did you guys even come close to recording that and not skip a beat on that?
I wrote the whole thing on piano.
Really?
Gee. And it must have sounded terrible. But I just had this idea, and I started to compose the piece, and I took it to the band, and they helped me construct it. They really understood what I was trying to do. It must have sounded pretty wild. When I don't play good piano, that's for sure. But
well, I'm a bass player myself, and I try to follow that, and I give up about it.
Again, it was very Stravinsky, you know, But it was really a great time. Again, they were excited to make music. They were happy, and they just followed. They trusted me, you know, and. I did this song soon all around the world, you know, and thousands and thousands of people. And I'm standing there at the end of the Gates of Delirium singing soon with all the laser beams. And I was never quite sure what it meant, the lights, you know. But I really believed inside there was something there. And I'll tell you the story, but... I was in Vegas, of all places. I'd done the show, and in a football field, I think it was about 15,000 people, and we were staying at Caesar's Palace. I always think Caesar's Palace, morning glory, for the human race. Went to see Frank Sinatra. And Frank Sinatra was an unbelievable performer. If you ever chance to have seen him, but I'd never seen him. I knew obviously who he was, and I sat there just amazed how good he was. And one time he was singing that song, Sending the Clowns, and he looked like a Chinese Mandarin to me. He looked like this ancient man, you know, and I thought, I want to meet him. So after the show, all the guys went to a big party in Vegas, you know. And I said, I'm not going, you know, I'm just, don't worry. And I went around to the side of the theater in Caesar's Palace to the, what supposedly would be the stage door, hoping that Frank would come out. Come on, you know, he had a tunnel that went under to his own private lift, elevator, you know. So I'm sitting there, and it's about midnight, and... I'm watching all these people play the slot machines and things like that, you know. And I feel this tapping on my shoulder, and so I turn around, it's a little girl, about 6, 7 years old, tiny little girl. And she said, John, are you ready? And I said, hello. And she said, are you ready, John? And it was just the way she spoke. And I thought, yeah, I'm ready. And she ran off and met with these two people that went through this swinging door, and I waved and goodbye, and turned around, there's a guy sitting next to me, like a Jamaican guy. And he said, John, are you ready? I said, what? He said, are you ready? I said, yeah, I think I need to go and have a drink. So I went to the bar, and he came and he followed me, and I said, who are you? He said, well, you can call me Lucky. I can win you $1 million, or you can meet with God. I'll meet with God, please. And he said, well, let's go somewhere quiet. So I said to the barman, forget the drink. I don't need a drink. And he said, let's go somewhere quiet. And I said, okay, let's go to my room. Because I knew I wasn't in the presence of just no ordinary person. This guy was... The energy coming from this guy was so calming. It was a wonderful experience to stand next to what I found out to be an angel. And we're walking towards my room, and he said, I'm going to be doing a chant when we get in the room. It'll sound so loud, but don't worry. Nobody can hear. I said, I'm not worried. Just what you got to do is what you got to do. So. I got in the room, I'm sitting on the bed, he stands to my left, there's a television there and a wall, he he put his hands above his head and started to chant this amazing sound. It was an extraordinary sound. And the wall disappeared. The television disappeared. And there was two beings just out there. And I dropped to my knees. And I put, thank you. I put my hands over my head like that. Because I was in the presence of something pretty interesting. And I was scared out of my mind. And I kept saying, I believe, but I didn't understand. I believe, but I didn't understand. As in, I believed there was God. I believed that there was a higher beings around us, but I didn't understand it was so real and so true. Anyway, this being came over, this godlike energy, this angel energy came over and put his hand over my head and said, you will be singing soon, or soon the light, my son, in the 21st century. I didn't understand, I don't believe this. I was crying, of course, I was a mess. But he said that, and here I am singing it. That's the truth.
Yeah.
And what happened was, the last time Yes played in Madison Square Gardens, my spiritual teacher came to the show. Beautiful, beautiful lady. And she said, would you mind if I get up and say a mantra to the audience towards the end of the show? And I thought, for me, yes, no problem, but I gotta ask the band, you know, because they might not, you know. And I went over to Chris and Steve and said, would you mind if Audrey Kitagawa, my spiritual teacher, got up and said a mantra? And he said, well, how long will it take? I said, I don't know, but it won't be that long. But she got up on stage and she started this mantra, which was exactly the same mantra this guy in 1977 in Vegas had said. It's a very ancient cosmic mantra. And Rick Wakeman was behind playing these amazing chords. And I remember that they told me that that would happen when it, as it was happening. That's one of the things that came to me. So the power of song is amazing. So I hope that answers your question.
John, what is your favorite piece of Yes music that you enjoy performing live, that moves you, the most emotional piece that Yes does? What is your favorite Yes piece that you like?
For me, it was always Awaken.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you how that came about. Yeah. Thank you. And I'll start playing it for you. We were at a Holiday Inn, and I was going for breakfast, and I went past Steve Howe's bedroom. You can always tell it was Steve Howe's bedroom. It's just the aura of the marijuana. You know. And I'm going past his bedroom, and the door's open. Actually, it's about 9 in the morning, and he's playing down, 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 down. And I'm standing outside saying, that's really good. So I went to have breakfast, and I'm coming back, passing her down. He's still playing the same thing. So I went to open the door, I said, Steve, I said, why don't you change key? And I came in and started singing, and we recorded it right away. Because I'd look at him and say, another key. And then I said, okay, that's the first part. Now, the second part, we need these chords. Don't ever play the same chords. The workings of man set to play out historical life, re-regaining the flower of the fruit of this tree. You know, so. I get carried away. But that's how it worked out. You know, it was like within the space of an hour or two, we'd actually written the stanzas for each part, you know, and then we went to Switzerland to record it, and that's when Rick rejoined the band, and it was a really wonderful experience because we really missed him, you know, terribly. I did, actually, and he came back in the band, and I told him about this piece that we were trying to do, and I said, there's a middle section where it's building up and it builds up and it builds up, and then we're going to just go down to harp and finger bells.
Nice.
Dun, 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 dun. I want to hypnotize the audience. Yeah. And I said, what I want you to do is to play church organ. And he said, thank you, John. And he went out and he found a church organ, which was about 7 or 8 miles away from the studio in a place called Vevey, because we actually recorded the album in Montreux in Switzerland. So how do we record the church organ onto the track? We do it with headphones, we'll do the track first. But I kept thinking, but the emotion of the band playing it all together is very important, because Chris has started doing this beautiful bass line, and then Steve was doing these slide steel guitars sort of sounds. So I kept thinking, how are we going to do this? And the technician at the studio said, listen, in Switzerland, they have perfect phone lines. We can actually plug in some microphones into a portable system, which we can plug in to the phone jack in the church, and then we can record exactly the same time in the studio. So you have the band in the studio, and 7 miles away was me on the harp and Rick on the church organ. And that's how the piece was recorded. It was just a magnificent sort of moment in my life, you know. And then Rick worked out these beautiful choral pieces, and a choir came in and sang the end. And I'd sit at the end of that piece of music and just listen to it in the speakers and just think, this is the life. This is wait till we do this on stage, you know.
Play a little bit.
Oh gosh, I wish I could really. The workings of man set to plough out historical life, re-regaining the flower of the fruit of his tree.
Great.
Yeah.
On that note, and you talk about playing the harp.
Yes.
And it's a beautiful instrument.
Mm.
And why do you not use that more often?
I play all the time in my studio. I'm actually working on a harp piece, a harp. I keep writing stuff, but it's like at the moment I'm sort of writing 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 different things at the same time. And they're all slowly moving towards being finished, and it's going to take time for them all to be finished. But a harp is just an extraordinary. I just close my eyes and play. It's just a wonderful. As you know, you play the harp. It's just. It's all wonderful.
It's a beautiful instrument,
yeah.
And I've seen you use it on your one solo tour.
Yeah, I did it once, yeah.
Yeah, so you haven't done it again.
I know.
And I look forward to that. That's really nice.
Yeah, well, time will come when I can, you know, do... Cause I feel like I'm going through transition time. That's why I do this one-man show with a guitar. It's very different, you know. In fact, I'll play another instrument. When I was recovering, and I must say that, you know, thank you to my wife Jane for saving my life twice. And I used to play this instrument that was given to me. No, I'm fine, thank you. I got my water. Thank you so much. Thank you. Can you hear this?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And I walk around the garden in my kimono and play this. You know, it's based on an ancient Chinese instrument. But they call it, here in America, they call it a mountain dulcimer. And it's just a fun instrument to play. Never gonna be in school forever. Never gonna stop until I free my soul. Never gonna be deceived forever. Never gonna stop until I see it all. never gonna drop that ball, keep running. Someone's gonna come and chase the blues away. Always you can see me winning. That's because I am believing. Always to the tune of wonder. That's why we are under heaven's door.
Harder or easier to play the music? Did it serve the music, or
At times, it cost a fortune.
Yeah.
That's what popped in my head. It cost a fortune. But you know, that's what you do when you know you get success. You want to invest in a better stage show. You're playing in front of 10,000 people, sometimes 15, 20. You want to put on a big visual event, you know. And most of the time, I'd say about 80% of the time, it worked. You know, it was kind of part of the going up. You know, I know that you too, you know, they did the zoo tour. You remember that? You ever seen that? Unbelievable. Unbelievable. It was like giant screens, and it nearly broke them financially, but they were putting on one of the greatest visual events. And I think that's what happens with musicians. They want to project, you know, put on the big show. And Roger Dean, of course, you know, if you look at Avatar.
Right.
It's so Roger Dean.
Oh, yeah.
It's unbelievable. Yeah. I actually rang up Roger. He was so upset. I didn't get a mention.
Yeah, I
said, yes, but what's that thing when somebody copies who you are?
Flattery.
Yes. But I remember, the last Yes tour we did with these blow-up visual sort of balloony sort of images. They were quite amazing. To look at the video, so it was a great video.
Was it fun at the time, though?
Well, I always thought I wanted it more, less bright. I wanted more theater. So I was always telling the lighting guy, can you make it less bright? And he said, no, Steve wants it bright. This wants it dark and bright. So in a band, you know, everybody has so many different opinions, you know. But that's the way it was, you know. Anybody know the album that I did called The Lias of St. Pillow?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Listened to it the other night.
Oh, good. Thank you. Being solo was at that period of time, right in the middle of the 70s, we'd done so many albums, and the idea was to do solo albums. I think it was Steve said he wanted to do a solo album, and Ricky was just starting one, and Chris said, oh, well, I'll do one then, that'll take me 10 years. But that's just Chris. And I said, okay, I'll do a solo album. But I'm not going to work with musicians, because solo means solo. So what I did, I locked myself in my garage with all these instruments I've been collecting. And I found myself a sitar, drums, flutes, guitars. I had a similar instrument to this, it's called a Kez from Turkey. So I just locked myself in the studio and learned to play them all and create an album at the same time. And it drove me crazy. Which is what you're supposed to do when you're an artist. You've got to go crazy, you know. But it was an amazing experience. There's one piece of music where the story's all about these four tribes. And it's based on a book that I read, that the four tribes create all tribes, the Asian, Oriental, Nordic, Negro. Out of all these four tribes, you create all tribes. And these are the four major tribes. And it's a beautiful book by a lady called Vera Stanley Alden. And she also wrote a great book called The Finding of the Third Eye, which we should all, everybody should read it. The Finding of the Third Eye. So, the beacon to the divine, which it truly is. But anyway, I wrote sort of a rhythm, sort of drum rhythms for the African Negro energy, and then I wrote sort of sitar, this kind of sound. I did about 20 tracks of each, and then choir. But there wasn't technology in those days to sort of like have them all come in together and play all together. So I had four tape recorders going into the big tape recorder. And I'd start them off one at a time. And 2 weeks later, I was going crazy. And I was trying to get them all to come in and get in tempo. Because they all had the same tempo, but in those days, they didn't have click tracks. It was a technical term for being able to have them all running at the same time. So it was a sort of a jigsaw puzzle. Start one, start the next one, start the next one, and then start the next one, and hope that they joined together music. And it happened. And it went over and over and over and over and over and over and over again. Actually, it's probably for about a week of trying it, 7 or 8 hours a day, driving myself crazy. And eventually, I was so tired, I started them off about 2 a.m, I set them going. Because they would never be in time. They'd always slightly go out of time with each other. And I fell asleep, and I woke up in the morning, it was bright, and the sun was shining, the birds were singing, and I thought, where the hell am I? And I thought, oh yeah, I'm trying to make this thing happen. So I went over to the main recording unit and pressed it, and everything was perfect. And I just sat there and cried. Because it was like, I'd come out of my madness. I nearly went crazy. And Jay loves these songs from Elias. I might actually do a production of it. This guy's going to help me. Homecome a daydream as a flower to me when you long have you been here?
We don't want to go home.
Not long enough.
Hey, no.
John, if I could take you back to the early 80s. I was 14 when 90125 came out. My first exposure to Yes, and only later did I realize how did it come about. It seemed like the first formation of Yes that was not sort of a planned formation of Yes.
True. I've actually left the band a couple of times along the way because of the friction that goes on with people when things aren't on, shall we say, a higher level of commitment. So I left the band with Rick at that time in the beginning of the 81. And I'd actually went down to live in the south of France, and I bumped into an amazing old guy, 90 years old, Chagall, Marc Chagall, can you imagine?
Jeez.
And he'd say, we met at a dinner, and he kept looking over at me, and I'd say, Marc Chagall. I had no idea who he was, but I knew he was famous. And he said, come here, come up to my house. And I went up to his house and watched him painting. And I saw his painting, and I just couldn't believe how amazing, how wonderful this guy was. And the amount of work that he'd done it during his life, and how great the work that he was doing between the ages of 70 and 80 and 90 years old. He started doing stained glass when he was 60 years old, 70 years old. Incredible stained glass. Anyway, I just fell in love with the guy, and I go up there and write songs for him, and write songs about his life, and actually sang songs to him, and he'd tell me all about what happened in Paris, in Russia, in New York, and things like that. And I went back to London, and I got a phone call from Chris, and he said, oh, John, would you like to listen to this album we're working on? We'd like you to maybe sing on it. And I said, okay. So he came along in his Rolls Royce, and parked outside the house, and I went out and sat in the car with him and listened to this really good music. And it was, at the time, it was that kind of music that was happening. It was kind of rock and roll music, but it had samples of things. There was a new technology happening, sampled music. It was kind of very hip, very cool recordings. The singing was really good. The songs weren't very strong to me. And Chris said, we'd like you to sing and maybe rewrite some of the songs because they need a little bit more of sort of John Anderson. I said, well, obviously, if I sing on the album, it'll be Yes. And he said, he had a wry smile on his face, and that's why I'm here. It was his way of saying he wanted me to join the band, rejoin the band. So I was very excited, I'd missed the idea of the band for a couple of years. So I just went in the studio and started rewriting some of the choruses and the lyrics. I wrote all the lyrics for sort of Honor of a Lonely Heart, The chorus was already there, and the production was already there. So I was like implanted into it, over a period of 2 weeks. And it was a very interesting time because the record company had invested a lot of money, and they were going to make sure it was going to be a hit record. And so everything was going on the up and up and up. I was going to become a rock star.
For the tour, what were the first pre-90125 songs that you rehearsed, and what was Trevor's reaction to that?
Well, Trevor really wasn't into any longer pieces of music, but he was happy to do, Heart of the Sunrise and, Yours and His Grace, as well as a lot of the new album. That was really the main thing. And, of course, Roundabout and things like that. But he just played them because he's a very good musician. But he was definitely going that way. He wasn't really into the history of Yes or anything like that. And we got on pretty well. We're actually great friends now. We've kept up our friendship over the years. But I must tell you the story. It was right at the beginning of the tour. And we played Philadelphia, then New York, and then we were going to Boston. And I kept saying to the management, all we need to do is to get a film crew or a couple of guys with cameras and film what's happening around the band. We're going to be mega famous. We're number one around the world. Come on, let's film it. So I said to the management, let's just get two guys straight out of film school. I don't want a big crew or anything like that. So we've got these two guys come straight out of film school. One on a camera, always on his shoulder, another had a boom mic. You know, and they followed us around for that first week and stuff. And then they did some editing, and they did incredibly funny what we were like, you know, backstage and the concerts and everything. It was really a lot of fun to watch. And so I got on with these guys, and so we drove to Boston together while the band had a private plane to fly them to Boston from New York. So me and these two guys were driving to Boston for the concert, and we stopped by a little town, and on the sort of, there was a cinema, and on the side of the cinema it said, Spinal Tap. And I said, what's that? And the guy said, oh, it's a rock and roll movie. I said, let's go and see it. So we went in to see Spinal Tap. Have you ever seen Spinal Tap? I never laughed as much in my life. It was me, these two guys, and a little old lady back in, you know, it was like 3 p.m. And it was the funniest experience because it was like every rock and roll band I've ever seen. It was like Yes on many levels. And I got to the gig and I couldn't stop telling Chris and Trevor, you gotta see this movie, Alan, you gotta see this movie. Spinal Tap, it's just the funniest thing. And they never went and saw it. So I spent that whole tour laughing all the way through because it was damn funny. And it just happens that the guy who I went to see the film with was Steve Sommelberg. His first gig was with Yes, you know. And then he went on to make great, and he still does great movies now. I want to thank you all for listening. I think I'll sing one more song. Is there any other questions? Thank you guys for hanging in there. It's tough, you know.
John Lennon, woo! 'Cause it's time with your